Thank you. I want to make a few quick comments, picking up on 4 points that have been made this morning, and then move on and make some general comments of my own. The first point I want to pick up is the question of fitting models to data. As a test developer and the supervisor of a team of test developers, if somebody came to me and offered me a model that would fit the kinds of data that I see, I think I'd tell them not to waste their time. What I want as a test developer is a model that will help me identify problems in a test, that will help me identify potential problems in a test, and not a model that will offer to go ahead and absorb the sorts of features that we typically find in test data. The answer to how to develop better tests doesn't lie in the data itself. It lies, in my opinion, in having a vision or a view of what our tests should consist of, what constitutes good measurement. In his paper, which you probably haven't had a chance to read yet, Ron refers correctly to the common practice in building models of the physical world to our practice of adding parameters to try to better explain the world we see around us. Test development is a very different game. When we develop tests, we're not in the business, or we need not be in the business of describing the data and explaining the data that we collect. We're in more control. We're in control when it comes to the question of what sorts of items we develop, what sort of response formats we use. We can have control. We can say what the data should look like. We're not in the business, as I say, of attempting to explain the data that we happen to collect. So that's my first point. Don't start with the data. At least not if they're anything like the data that I typically see. Start with some view about what constitutes good measurement and what sorts of characteristics we want to see in a test. The second point that I scribbled down, differences in discrimination. When you and I write test items, of course, we see differences in item discrimination, inevitably. And it's not surprising, then, that we can find tests, as we've seen today, where we can analyse the test, look at the discrimination of the items and find differences in discrimination. Ron makes the point in his paper that there's a long history of using point by serials to capture this difference, and uses that as an argument for continuing with the discrimination parameter in a two-parameter or three-parameter model. Point by serials, though, were developed, of course, not as parameters to describe characteristics of items, but as an index for identifying problematic items. And so in that sense, a point by serial probably has more in common with the philosophy of the Roche model in identifying problematic items. As a test developer, I'm not sure that I want a model that says to me, give me any item discrimination, I'll go ahead and absorb it, which is what the two-parameter model or three-parameter model will do for us. If the discrimination is low, the models say, that's not a problem. We'll just weight that item down when it comes to estimating ability. If it has no discrimination, I guess we keep the item and give it no weight in the limit. In my experience in analysing tests, am concerned about this because I'm not sure that there's any such thing as a perfectly acceptable item that happens to have an unusually low item discrimination. When I've looked at test analyses and I've found items with unusually low discriminations, inevitably they've been bad items. They're not items that I want kept in my test and given a lower weight. They're items that I want identified. I want a model that's going to blow some whistles and ring some bells when those items are encountered and give me an opportunity to look at them and to remove them from the test. Similarly, Ron makes the point in his paper that there can be problems with highly discriminating items. High item discrimination can be a symptom of a problem with an item, and if that's the case, I think what I would want as a test developer is an opportunity to look at all unusually highly discriminating items just in case. One of the problems that we know can result in high discrimination is behind that unusually high discrimination. Third point, throwing away items. There's an often stated belief that users of the Roche model and perhaps users of IRT models in general throw away items when they don't fit the model, as though they simply look at the statistics and then throw away anything that looks on a statistical basis as though it doesn't fit. In my work and in my work with others using IRT models, I find that that's a very rare occurrence for people to throw away items on the basis of statistical fit alone, partly because it's an expensive business, developing items. When we developed in Australia the TORCH tests of reading comprehension, people said to me afterwards, you defined reading comprehension to fit the Roche model. You threw away the items that didn't fit the Roche model, and so you changed the definition of the reading comprehension construct as the Roche model requires. In fact, that's nonsense. The items that we threw away were just bad items. They were ambiguous items. They were items that introduced, when you looked at them carefully, introduced possibilities that we hadn't identified in the process of developing the tests. We weren't simply throwing away acceptable items that happened to define different dimensions. We were throwing away, as I say, items that were problematic. And that experience, I think, is quite general. That observation is quite general in my work with people who work with IRT models. Then finally, this fourth observation on tests of fit. Any model, the Roche model included, is of course an ideal. It's only a model, like the concept of a perfect circle or a perfect straight line. It's something that may not even be realised perfectly in practice, but we don't use that as a basis for throwing away the equation for a perfect circle. You show me a circle and claim that it's a perfect circle, and I'll show you that if you can look at it carefully enough, it's slightly warped. And that you can never have, perhaps, a perfect circle or a perfect straight line, for that matter. But we don't, as I say, use that as a basis for throwing away the idea of a straight line. We continue with the equation, we continue trying to approximate it, and we recognise that for particular purposes, certain levels of approximation will be good enough. A child playing hopscotch on the sidewalk will be happy with one level of approximation to a straight line. A bricklayer will be happy with another level of approximation, and perhaps an aeronautical engineer or somebody would be still more stringent. And similarly with fit to the Roche model, it's always possible for people to argue that if we applied more rigorous tests of fit, we could show that violations of the model were occurring. The real question is there a point at which the fit is good enough for the purpose that we have in mind? Well, if I still have a couple of minutes, let me move on from those specific points to make the more general points that I was going to make today. I think the answer to the general question, the topic of this debate, IRT in the 1990s, which models work best, is... Well, I'll tell you. The general answer is the models that will work best for us in this decade are the models that are best able to solve the practical measurement problems that we're going to encounter in the 1990s. As we all know, and there's been reference to it this morning, measurement itself is changing. The practice of measurement technology is changing, there are changing emphases, and I expect we'll continue to see this during this decade of the 1990s. There's less emphasis on paper and pencil testing, particularly multiple choice testing, even in this country. There's more emphasis on authentic assessment or alternative assessment or performance assessment. You only have to look in the index of this year's AERA handbook to appreciate how this area is growing and how there is more and more interest in authentic performance assessment, more interest in open-ended items than closed item types that we've used in the past. items that differentiate among individuals on the basis of the kind of response that's given, more interest in professional judgment rather than objective right-wrong scoring, more interest in tests of conceptual understanding rather than tests of passive knowledge, tests that are designed to look at learning from the perspective of the learner, tests that are designed to expose the kinds of misconceptions or errors that students are making at an individual level, and more interest in descriptive reporting, the interpretation of test results in descriptive terms rather than purely numerical terms. And if I were asked to say which models will work best for us in the 1990s, my answer would be that the models that will work best for us in the 1990s will be the ones that are most relevant to these changing emphases in educational measurement, the ones that will be most helpful in solving the kinds of practical measurement problems that these new directions are going to throw up. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Our third discussant will be Wim van der Linden from the University of Twente.